I was dead from wrong, and I'll die in
here. Welcome to our group.
And this ought to show it right here.
Do you or someone you know suffer from depression? If so, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our weekly Medical Tuesday broadcast with your host, our Colonel Kimberly Purvis. Now, for those of you new just tuning in to us, be sure to check out our national Facebook page by typing in the search box, all capital letters, Defenders 7. Before you hit that join button, just know we expect all of our members and future members to participate throughout all we do here in the Defenders 7. Check out and subscribe to our website, all lowercase letters, www.defenders7.com. On our site, you'll find that we have a store and a donate button. 100% of all sales from our store and any donations we bring in go back to our communities throughout all 50 states in a time of need. So please, by all means, purchase something from our store or hit that donate button. Help us to help you and your community in time of need. That's the only way that we're able to do what we do here, is by sales from our store and donations. Check out and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We're on MeWe. Click on Communities. Scroll down. Defender 7, Humanitarian American Patriot Group. Yes, that's right, folks. We are not a militia. Tonight's show and all the shows we do here on Blog Talk Radio, we do enjoy it when you call in and participate. And that number to call, area code 914-205-5773. Too shy to call. We also have a live chat room right here on Blog Talk during all of our broadcasts. So either way, come on in and participate. Now, before I turn it over to your host, I'd just like to say I'd like to send out a lot of prayers to those in Florida, that you don't get hit with as bad as they say it's getting. And we will keep you in our prayers. And now I turn the microphone over to your host, our Colonel, Miss Kimberly Purvis.
Hello, howdy, howdy. Hello. How's you?
I'm hanging in there, you?
Oh, you know, you win some, you lose some, and right now I'm losing some. my body's like, I hate you, bitch. I'm going to tell you what. The next orthopedic surgery that I have, it better be life or death. Because this shit ain't cracking. I am not doing this shit again. I mean, like I said, unless it's life and death. Because the hell with this shit. As much crap that I went through on this friggin' surgery, I mean, yeah, it fixed the problem. Yada, yada, shmada. You know the whole nine yards. Right shoulder right now, it's inflamed. And it's, I could feel it compared to my left shoulder. And I know it has to be from what he did, scraping the bones and all that crap. But I think aside from the adhesive that my body does not like and the stitches as well. So, yeah, my body's not liking any of this. I had to take off the Band-Aids now. I've got blisters on the up by my neck and then on my back where, it, you know, where they had it all taped up. So around the, on my side or on the back, that has blisters. And I'm like, I'm over this. Completely over this shit.
I hear you.
So I went ahead and bought some Motrin, and I'm just taking that. I'm not really – I'm saving the, you know, the Oxy for my physical torture when that starts on the 11th. I'm going to save it for those – for twice a week when I have to go.
Right.
So, you know, because I'm like, nope. With me just changing clothes, right, and what little bit I move my arm, I want to puke because of the pain afterwards.
I bet.
And so when I go to the bathroom, the only time it hurts is when I go to the bathroom. Well, not when I go to the bathroom. It's when I have to pull my pants back up. That's the hard part. And then changing clothes and taking a shower. And I ain't showering every day. I don't do shit, so I ain't showering every day. What's the point?
Right.
You know, I wash up, you know, in the sink and stuff. But I'm like, this is too much undue torture. Nope. So I actually drove today. I didn't do too bad, actually, because I haven't taken any pain medicine in 2 days. And, you know, I haven't needed it, really. And the only time, like I said, the only time I really hurt is if I move just the wrong way for just a brief moment. And it hurts. With a sling, without it, I don't care. Doesn't matter. And I don't know if I'm supposed to, and I don't really don't give a shit. But I take the sling off for a little bit if I'm just sitting still doing nothing because it's just, oh, my God, it's killing me. And, like, when I sleep, I wear it. But, like, today I've had it off for, like, an hour or so, and I'm not moving. And so... Yeah, I'll probably get bitched at by my doctor. But, you know, sorry.
Speaking of doctors, Dr. Phil's on. Hey, guys.
Yeah. Hey.
How's everybody?
Yeah, good. We're doing.
You. Hey, you're supposed to wear that sling for at least 2 weeks to give the tissues time to heal, and then you start taking it off.
Well, no, I know. But when I take it off, it's because my arm can't breathe. And so I'll leave the pillow on. I just take my arm out of the – I loosen the sling part, and I just sit down. And I'm claustrophobic. That's the problem. So I got to kind of – I got to adapt.
But it's not like your head is
it.
In the sling. Hello.
Oh, no, no, I can't, when I say claustrophobic, I mean, like, if I can't move my arms or my legs, my body starts to panic, and so, yeah, I'm not, like, swinging my arm around and moving it, no, I'm just letting it breathe,
yeah,
for just a little bit.
It's meant to immobilize it at least temporarily until it heals, and also to prevent you from accidentally overextending it and damaging something. So,
oh yeah, I know. Yeah. No, I know.
But
I got like a two inch.
At least 2 weeks.
Two
put
inch
up
clear.
With it as much as you can. Yeah, and then you know after that point,
you
might not even need it anymore.
I got a 2 inch clearance. That's how much room I got to take it off. So I can change clothes and take a shower. That's all I'll move my arm away from my side, but 2 inches. That's it.
Yeah, well, they just don't want you to do your ponytail or do your bra strap from behind. That's all.
Oh hell no! That's not even an option right now to do my hair. I brush it, use my left hand, put mousse in it, scrunch it up, boom, I'm go. That's about it.
How about them Cowboys, I said, how about them Cowboys?
They finally win a game?
Yeah, they finally won a game. They sure did. It's the only time I didn't put money on them, huh?
Go figure. That's why they won.
I'm just kidding. They got no money to put on them. Biden has it all.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, you put in your gas tank.
So before we get into your show, Tim, have you guys been keeping an eye on what's going on in Alaska?
No.
Our Coast Guard, our Navy, and Special Forces are being approached by Russian and Chinese ships.
Oh yeah, and they're flying the their bombers out there too.
Yep.
In the Alaskan airspace, yeah. I heard about that. I haven't heard about any conflicts.
I think they're going to strike.
Yeah. Well, the Pope said we're already at World War III.
As of 5 o'clock today, because I've been watching it all morning. As of 5 o'clock today, several Coast Guard ships and several more of our Navy ships have entered the area.
Well, I haven't seen anything on like the mainstream media though talking about that yet.
You won't. Because it's facts and it's truth. No, they don't report the facts and truth.
Mm-mm, no. I mean, usually Fox News will throw something out there, tidbit here and there, because they're expecting something with all the shit that Biden's been pulling, but they haven't, they're like silent on it too, I guess.
Yep.
Alaska's been hit with massive storms as late too.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Yeah, my aunt lives by Orlando, and they're still trying to recuperate from a storm they had earlier or late summer, and a tree was uprooted and fell on the roof, and they have no roof on the living room, the bedroom, and a bathroom, and so they had to go hire someone today to cut the limbs off the tree because with this hurricane coming in, it could do more damage to the house. So it's a mess there.
Do they got a good pass on that yet? Because it looked like it was going to hit, the panhandle of Florida and go up through Alabama. And then they thought it was going to hit the bottom part of Florida. And I don't know. Is it over Florida already? Or is it still out in the Gulf?
It's in the Gulf. Hold on. Damn phone.
It's already touched. I think it was Fort Lauderdale.
Hold on one second. Yeah, it's going to hit right now. It's got, it's going to be a Category 4. Actually, it is Category 4. Hitting Cape Coral. I think that's what it is. Hold on a second. No, that's not what it is. Hold on. It's already hitting Florida. Mm-hmm. The top part of the band, the outer part of it, it's already hitting the bottom part of Florida and Cape Coral. And
what's going on, boss?
This hurricane is so large.
Yeah.
It's
large.
There's
a pickup truck sitting over here on the little side street looking this way. Can you keep your eyes?
The gray one? Yeah, it's coming.
He's right there. Okay.
I know it's hitting Tampa, too.
It's hitting what?
Tampa.
Yeah. The top part's hitting Tampa now. Hold on a second. Listen here. You pain in my ass.
Thanks, Bill.
This phone's ticking me off. There, you see that picture? It's the way it's going to hit, it's going to go straight up.
It might be headed to Bobby's house.
The worst portion of the hurricane is, I'm trying to think of which part of the wind.
The worst part of a hurricane is the right front quadrant with respect to movement. Yes.
Yeah, so when it comes through.
Yeah, so anything to the northeast of it as it's moving north.
Yeah, the back side or the right side will be hitting, going right through Orlando and stuff. And so and now it's a Category 4.
Bobby, I hope you got your generator ready and your chainsaw.
Yeah, but all we wind up getting is just rains and a little wind.
Yeah, well, I hope that's the case. I pray for you.
That's why we're so far inland.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's supposed to hit, depending on which way it tracks, if it still pushes out towards the east, it'll only get part of Georgia, mid-Georgia, you know, to south. But if it goes anywhere west, up a little bit, it's going to go right through Tallahassee, up and around, and you'll get a lot of that. And Tennessee will end up getting some, but mostly as a tropical storm, 40 mile an hour.
That elevation will tear it apart real quick. But you know what? Hey, man, I'll just come over there, Bobby, and we can start an Uber canoe service.
There you go.
Yeah.
Ooh, who else is on?
Just the three of us right now.
Just the three of us. Building big castles in the sky. Yeah. Oh, that ain't the way it is. Where's Lorna? I haven't heard from her in a long time. She's still doing that, building those, was it like Home Depots or something like that?
Oh, no, she just started a new job on Monday.
Oh, okay.
I'm waiting for her to sign in because she usually calls in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So with that, I got to ask my doctor or the surgeon. I don't know what the hell they did. You know where all my pain is at? My foot.
Your ass.
My foot. Because I swear to God, the whole top of my right foot is swollen and I can't even move it. I got stuck 8 times with an IV. It infiltrated when I was in surgery and they stuck me 7 times in my left arm. And then they stuck me in my left foot and then they finally got me in my right foot. And oh my God, my freaking foot is so swollen. I can't even bend my foot down. And I'm going to ask them if they used a 14-gauge needle to get that friggin' IV started. It's like, Jesus.
So they put the IV in your foot?
Yeah, top of my foot.
They didn't do any epidurals or anything like that, did they?
No, I got a nerve block.
Yeah, a nerve block in your back?
In my neck.
In your lumbar? Oh, in the neck?
No, my neck.
So you were awake. You were awake during the procedure.
Yeah. Oh no! No! They do a nerve block because of pain control.
But the neck nerves don't affect the lower extremity. You probably got some colitis going on. Yeah.
No. It had to be from where they suck it. It was right on the side of my big toe, up on the top of the foot. So it's between my big toe and the next toe, and wherever they put it, I swear to God, they just rammed it in there, because it's swollen.
That's a damn place. Yeah. Is it red?
Well, here's the thing. When I first got into pre-op, they don't like using your AC because I'm like, I'm asleep. Why the hell would they care? But she missed one vein blue. Then they had to use the ultrasound. So they finally got it. Then they used the ultrasound for my, for the nerve block. And I'm like, you ain't sick of me in the friggin' neck with that damn needle to do a nerve block. And she's like, the anesthesiologist is like, oh, no, we're going to give you I don't care juice. I'm like, well, you better give it to me now because I do care. And honestly, because I've had so much acupuncture and dry needling, it didn't even hurt when he did it. And it took him like 2 minutes. And so when they brought me back, I guess the IV infiltrated and they stuck me 5 more times. Because it was 8 altogether. And then they tried on the top of my left foot. That didn't work. And they had to use the ultrasound again in the OR. And I was in surgery for over 3 hours.
Yeah, it sounds
and
like...
And it was only supposed to be 2.
If it's not red, then most likely they blew the vein out.
Oh, I don't know what he did, but it's
sore. If it's just swollen, swollen and sore.
It's not bruised.
Lower extremity edema. They probably blew the vein out, and your body will make new veins, anastomosis they call it, but it'll make new veins, and it'll make some valves to shut off other parts of the vein. You have little knots there, but that swelling should go down, and if you elevate your foot above your heart and let gravity drain it, it'll drain off.
Oh, okay. I'll try that. I'll raise my foot up.
But if it gets red, then it sounds like a thrombophlebitis. You might have a little blood clot in there or something. So that's something to be, keep your eye on.
Oh, I'm still looking. My foot's just red. It's not red. It's not warm. It's just swollen and it hurts.
Yeah.
So I'll check it on Monday.
That could be a DVT also,
Oh, on the top of my foot?
Yeah, well, it would be a deep vein thrombosis. It would probably be just like a superficial thrombosis. But, your body, if they poke through your vein one end and it goes out the other end and you're leaking blood, you're gonna clot. You're going to have a blood clot. You'll end up having edema and pain. Like, you'll have for example, a lot of times we'll catch DVTs, like, in the gastric nemus, in the cap. You squeeze the cap, it's called a positive Hammond sign. And if it's painful, but it's not necessarily red, it's just swollen or painful. And that could be a DVT, so just, are you taking aspirin?
No.
No? Nothing that's in your blood at all?
I've been taking Motrin, that's the only thing that's slightly,
I had some antiplatelet. Naproxen's even stronger as far as blood thinner when it comes to NSAIDs go.
I might take it once a day.
Yeah,
at least.
But take it with food for sure.
But yeah, when I got out, they called Pat, my son. They called him. The doctor called him at 11. He goes, "Okay, we're done." And then so he went ahead and went back up to the hospital. And I was in recovery for 4 hours, and they had to resedate me because my blood pressure was so high and the pain, I guess. And I woke up after 2 o'clock, and I'm like, okay. And yeah, it was like 247 over 115.
That hurt again.
Whoa.
Yeah, and that's what I said. But
is that Lorna, or is that Steph?
That's Steph.
Oh. Hi, Sis.
Hi.
How you doing?
Oh, my God, I'm tired. I've been running my ass off. I go from sitting on my ass. I go from sitting
on my ass.
That's an awful
big ass to be running off.
You got a fatter ass than me there, Sonny Jim.
I ain't got no ass.
He has a no ass at all.
I like it when they say kiss my ass and I say, well, pick a spot, but don't confuse yourself because you're all ass.
X marks the spot. You're all ass.
So what are we talking about tonight?
Well, I guess we're going to go ahead and go over some. Where'd it go? Oh, here it is. Sudden death in athletes with cardiac problems. And this is quite interesting how many different issues there are.
You know, it's funny, though. Most of them are genetic, though. You know that.
You okay?
Yeah, the majority of them are genetic. And what's fascinating is there is a higher propensity for a male African-American. Fascinating stuff.
So when they do all the sports physicals, I mean, I know a lot of times that their biggest thing is, like with my son, who had high blood pressure, and he played football, and, you know, they made a big deal about his blood pressure being high. So he was on blood pressure medication. And as long as he played, he stayed on the medicine, and now he's got to go back on it again. But that was the big thing that they looked for back then when he played. And
they look for what, blood pressure?
Yeah. If you have high blood pressure, you got to have – because they didn't want him to have a stroke. Or that was the biggest concern for them is their blood pressure. They really didn't screen for anything else, you know.
Yeah, no, that doesn't sound right, but I guess that's the way it was. But no, we screen athletes for several things that are really important. Vision is one. You have a person who has say they have a blind eye, and they only have one eye. You know they have vision out of one eye, so they're not going to have good peripheral vision. For one thing, they get hit in the head when the ball's flying at them, and they don't have very good depth perception with one eye either. So vision is very important. Hearing is another very important issue. But the two main things we look for is, first of all, we look for hernias, and the reason we look for those hernias is because strenuous athletic activities can cause strangulation of the hernia, which could cause, well, ultimately death, right? Not rapid. And their cardiopulmonary system, their lungs and their heart. So the main two important things that we look for is the hernia check. All the guys know about the turn the head and cough. And a lot of doctors are getting away from doing it, and they're going to find liability if something happens to some of these kids. And then cardiovascular check. But the vision and the hearing and the coordination are just as important, and all those things should be checked during a sports physical, especially in youngsters. And if
the
parents need to be aware of that and speak up and say, hey, WTF.
Well, I mean, back then, I mean, it's been 8 years since he's played football in college. So even farther back than that, when he was in Pee Wee League, Rec League, elementary, middle school and stuff, they really didn't do all of that. One of the biggest concerns for him was he used to bruise real easy because he was anemic. And they thought he was a hemophiliac because one day he got hit hard. He got double teamed, and he had bruises all over his shoulders and across his chest. And so we had to pull him from football, and the team was crushed. But he had to have a complete physical clearance before they let him go back. and they checked him for hemophilia and everything else. And the doctor's like, no, he's not a hemophiliac. We did all the blood work, come to find out he was just anemic, you know. And for some reason, anemia seems to run in my family, especially on my mom's side. And they always told him, look, if you don't want a bruise, you hit first. And after he changed the way he played, he stopped bruising all the time. So, but yeah, I thought it was weird how they changed how they do all the physicals over the years. And a lot of the sudden cardiac death is quite young, and some young athletes.
I played football when I was 12, and I had to have a sports physical, and it was a complete sports physical, and I had to turn your head and cough
and the entire physical thing,
and that was many years ago. That wasn't just like 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, but how would they know? Certain things for genetics, like. You sent me the thing on, as a matter of fact, I'll look it up right here and I'll show you, on the Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome.
Okay, uh-huh.
Now, here's what's funny. It says it's fairly rare.
No, it's not.
It's not, because
no,
both
it's
of
not.
My stepsons had it.
Uh-huh.
One died from it. Well, okay, here's the thing. He had it, and he played high school football. And
yep.
His mom knew that he had it. But when he had his physicals,
mm-hmm.
It never came up.
No.
And she never said anything.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is, a lot of times it has to do with the competency of the person doing the physical. For example, if you auscultate the heart and you hear a murmur, you just rapidly move on. But if you know what you're doing, you're actually going to try to bring that murmur out of hiding, or you're going to try to bring that irregular heart rhythm out of hiding by having him squat, kneel, stand up, turn on his left side, squeeze your fingers, hold his breath, you know, a real good cardio exam. A lot of providers aren't very good at doing it. They expect to go up and put their stethoscope on two places on the chest, and if they don't hear anything abnormal, then they give them a clearance. So a lot of these things are missed. The reason why Wolff-Parkinson-White is not considered that common is because it's missed. A lot of providers don't hear it. They don't hear the irregular rhythms going on, and they assume they have normal cardiac function. And then all of a sudden, the guy goes tachycardia, and he gets AFib, and he checks out with a blood clot or something, you know?
Yeah, because what's weird is both of the four kids, two are girls, two are boys. Both of the boys had Wolff-Parkinson-White. Of the six grandsons, between all the kids, five of the boys have it. One is because he's not a blood relative. So he doesn't count because it's
right.
Not blood. So
yeah, there is a genetic component to that, definitely.
Yeah, but he died
yep.
from it at 27. Now,
and so if you get a family history and you find out, okay, he has the Wolff-Parkinson-White, then you try even harder to make it rear its ugly head, or you do the simple thing and refer to the cardiologist to get cleared. But if, like, say, the family is not aware of the family history, or even it's the foster child or something, you know, then the provider doing the physical needs to look for those conditions that's going to kill that kid. And so he's going to want to try to bring out the Wolff-Parkinson-White. He's going to try to bring out the hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. He's going to try to bring out the Bugaderis syndrome. I mean, because that's the whole reason why the kid is there getting the sports physical to begin with.
Yeah, he, well, here's the thing with him. After he got out of the military, he played high school football. He joined the military. He was part of the 82nd Airborne. He went his whole military career, it never even got brought up. So I don't know if he just flew by the seat of his pants because he knew he had it, and he still got in the military. So,
yeah, but when you went for your MEPS, did they do an EKG?
For me, yes, because I was 37.
Okay.
He was only 19 or 20.
They don't typically do an EKG, and sometimes Wolf Parkinson's White won't even show up on an EKG. It has to be done with a Holter monitor, and they have to wear it for a week. So,
no, I know.
If he doesn't disclose it and they are not aware of it, you know, they're not really going to look. They're not going to make everyone wear a Holter monitor for a week because they're looking for zero.
Oh, no. But so anyway, when he got out of the military, he went into trucking, and he did trucking. And because of the long driving, he drank a lot. Oh, my God. This boy drank so much Monster and Red Bull and all of that crap. So on top of the strain of driving, drinking the Red Bull, he drank a lot of alcohol, and then the dumbass got a tattoo. And within the same day, he had all of that. And he went into and had just sudden cardiac death. He died in the bathtub, taking a bath. And they did CPR for like 45 minutes because it took a while before they even found him in the bathroom. And he died. And they questioned, they questioned his wife because, one, she had belladonna plant in the house, and they actually accused her. I'm like, okay, I can think of other ways of doing it. They had to do a full investigation, and of course, there was no belladonna in the system, and that's what they came right back to was that. But he's the only one who did sports because none of the boys do. And so now,
it's treatable with an ablation and pacemaking, you know. But
yeah, but can you play sports though?
It's up to the cardiologist. Honestly, it's up to the cardiologist. If your Wolf Parkinson's White has been ablated and you're normal pacing, yeah, I don't see why not. But I'm not a cardiologist, so I can't answer that question completely.
Yeah. So we'll just go over really quick over what it is. So some of the symptoms of Wolf Parkinson White is rapid heartbeat, over 100 beats a minute. So those episodes can last or start suddenly, and they can go from a couple of seconds, minutes, to even hours. I don't know if that's – can it really go that long for hours?
Yeah, it can.
But it says that it can happen during exercise or even at rest. That would kind of suck. So other signs and symptoms of it are related to fast heart rate, like I said, and then arrhythmias. So one of the most common arrhythmias seen with it is SVTs, or supraventricular tachycardia. It's a mouthful. SVTs cause episodes of a fast pounding heartbeat that begin and end abruptly. And some people with Wolf Parkinson White also, what is a chaotic heart rhythm? Oh, AFib. I've never heard it called that before.
Well, me either.
this is from Mayo Clinic where I looked it up. But I've actually, you know, of course, you're not going to hear everything. But, yeah, that's called AFib. I didn't know that. But,
Well, I think VFib could be a chaotic heart rhythm, too.
No kidding. I know. I'm like,
Any rhythm that's going to cause chaos. So, yeah. AFib is bad because. Yeah, go ahead.
What's the difference between AFib and VFib? On
AFib, the rhythm. AFib, the top part of the heart, is going faster than the bottom part of the heart. It's not in sync.
But I mean, on a EKG strip, you know, it looks like little up and down, up and down. So are they both considered the same thing when you look at it, or is it shaped differently?
No, there's different patterns. You're looking at like a sawtooth pattern on the ECG. Yeah, that's going to be more like a V-fib type of pattern, where the AFib is going to affect more like of your P wave, and so you're not going to have as much. You're going to see little quivers, and then you're going to see the S2. You're going to see an S1 quiver, and then you're going to see an S2 normal beat. So you're going to see like da-da-da-da-da, lub. So you know how they say lub, dub, lub,
yeah,
dub.
Yeah, lub, dub,
it's gonna,
yeah.
It's going to be like la-la-la-la-lub, dub, la-la-la-la-lub, dub, la-la-la-la-lub,
dub. Oh, okay. I gotcha. Okay.
So the top part of the heart or the atrium is beating faster than the bottom heart. And what happens, because it's beating so fast, the blood actually will pool into the atrium and it's not being ejected out because it doesn't have, even though it's beating fast, it doesn't have the strength to squeeze the blood out of the atrium. So the blood pools in there and it can clot, and that can throw a clot, whether it become a cerebral clot or it becomes a DVT or a pulmonary clot. They call them embolism.
I didn't realize it could clot that fast.
Yes, it can, and that is why a person that has AFib, if they're not controlled, then they're on a blood thinner, and a good blood thinner, too, so that it prevents them from clotting.
Oh, okay. So these are just general signs and symptoms. Like we said, heart palpitations, chest pain, difficulty breathing, dizziness, fainting, fatigue, shortness of breath, and anxiety. And infants, they can even be pale or have really faded skin color, blue or gray coloring to the skin, the lips, and the nails, which is called cyanosis, restlessness or irritability, rapid breathing or poor eating. Now, like with babies with the poor eating, you with babies, if there's anything wrong, they're like, nah, I'm done. I'm not going to eat. So, I mean, that's why it's important to pay attention when your babies, when they don't eat, it just, you know, pay attention what's going on around the circumstances, unless they got a stomach bug or something. So some people with an extra electrical pathway don't have signs or symptoms of a fast heartbeat. Is that what that's what the extra electrical pathway is? Is the Wolf Parkinson's white?
It could be, but it's also an interruption in the electrical pathway. So it's just an abnormality when it comes to from the sinus node to the AV node and to the Purkinje fibers. So the electrical pathway, there's an abnormality, and most of the times it's genetic. Some people do, and when they have just the plain abnormality, you're going to notice that they're having tachycardia at times, or they're having just a normal heart rhythm that might go tachy when they breathe deeply or something. But people who have an additional pathway, it's the body trying to correct the problem. So sometimes those two pathways get out of sync. So, you know, the one pathway is saying you need to be beating fast, but the other pathway is like a pacemaker, keeping it at a regular beat. And then sometimes when those two pathways, when one doesn't overrule the other one, that can be a problem. And they have to go in there and they have to ablate those pathways so you get a good electrical circulation in the heart. And you can pick those up on EKG. If you do a good 12-lead EKG and you do it long enough, because sometimes you can have a very normal heart rhythm for days with Parkinson's white and not even realize until you put on a monitor and it's monitored longer. But so also,
yeah.
some EKGs can pick it up right away.
Now, would be a difference between a 5-lead, a 7-lead, and a 12-lead EKG?
Yeah, 12-lead would be a better measure of the electrical system of the heart. But, you know, most clinics, like, you know, just a doctor, they're going to have a smaller system.
Yeah.
Most likely 5 to 7-lead. But your cardiologist, you know, and the ones in the hospital, they should be hooking up. You know, if you're, you know, in telemetry or if you're part of a cardiology issue, you should be on a 12-lead and not just a lower.
Yeah, the VA here, they do 7-leads.
Mm-hmm.
When they did my EKG to clear me for my surgery. Now,
yep.
When I was in with cardiac problems years ago, oh, yeah, you had 12-leads. The telemetry,
yep.
All of that hooked up. And they always 12-lead.
Shoot, what's fascinating now is that these watches that are coming out, they're able to pick up on issues like that.
Huh.
Arrhythmias, yep, they can pick up on arrhythmias. They can pick up on sleep apneas and hypoxemias. And these watches are pretty, pretty intelligent right now. So I can't afford them, obviously, but.
Of course, you're like a small computer. When computers first came out back in the 90s, when a computer, a desktop was the size of a television, you know.
And a hard drive took up an entire office space. Yeah, I remember those days.
Oh yeah, back in the day. So, oh crap, my neck was broke.
Your nipple broke.
My necklace.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought I heard that. No wonder the baby doesn't want to eat.
Yeah, look, I am 51. I ain't having no kids right now.
Well,
I have
powdered
no
milk is always good.
Huh?
Powdered milk
what?
Is always good.
Yeah, funny.
I said, you said you're 51.
I'm 51. So,
yeah.
Funny, I have no equipment, so.
You got powdered
milk. The other one I wanted to go over is, like we were talking about, the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Now, from these diagrams, from what I could see, it's so with the disease when the heart muscle becomes thickened or hypertrophy, and the thickened heart muscle can make it harder for the heart to pump blood. It often goes undiagnosed because many people with the disease have very little symptoms, if any. However, in a small number of people with it, it can cause shortness of breath, chest pain, or changes in the heart's electrical system, but which also can cause irregular heart or arrhythmias or sudden death. But according to this picture, I don't know if they just made it for this one particular picture, is it always... Hold on a second. I can't read it here. Is it always the left ventricle? Or can it be either one?
No. A lot of times it has to do with the left atrium. And it's the valve between the atrium and the ventricle. Because if you look at the heart as being a four-chambered, where it's got a wall in the middle, and then it has a transverse wall to divide it into four chambers. When that middle wall is thicker or wider than it's supposed to be, they call that hypertrophy of the muscle,
yeah.
Of that middle wall. That valve that sits there between the atrium and the ventricle can be impeded from opening or closing if that wall pushes on it when the heart is trying to contract hard. That makes sense?
Yeah, it's your mitral valve, right? The one
the mitral valve, right, the mitral valve. And so what happens is that mitral valve opens and closes so that the heart, the blood flows only in one direction. It doesn't backflow. Well, if that thing gets stuck shut because it's being blocked by the wall of the heart and it can't open, well, blood keeps filling in there and, it, you know, boom, you're not getting circulation. Or if it gets stuck open, blood is not going to flow because when you squeeze the heart, it goes out, and when the heart relaxes, it sucks right back in. So you're not getting blood flow, circulation, and if you don't get it to the brain, you die. And that's what happens.
Yeah.
Either that valve is being locked open or it's being locked closed because of the thickness of the muscle in the heart causing it to be blocked. It blocks it. That's one of the simple ways to describe it.
So what would cause, because I have mild tricuspid valve and mitral valve regurge. It's really mild. So
okay.
What would cause the two valves to, like, not close all the way?
A lot of times calcifications on them. Like, you get some calcium deposits around them. Sometimes vegetation such as bacteria or even funguses that can get on the leaflets of the valve, and or CHF, a weakened heart muscle from, like, say, long-standing hypertension causing the heart muscle to enlarge and the heart not being able to contract as strong as it used to, meaning that the valve can't snap shut as strong as it used to. So,
yeah, I found out. Half the time they don't even hear the murmur that I have.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah, they'll see, like, it best on echo.
Yeah,
they'll find those best on echocardiogram.
Oh, yeah, I had one done like 8 years ago, whatever, and that's when they said I have the tricuspid and mitral valve regurge and then mild aortic valve stenosis.
Yeah,
but
and aortic stenosis is function of aging, and a lot of times it has to do with calcium deposits as well.
Is there
so
any
the older
sort
you...
of medication
yes.
that's best?
Yes, there sure is. One of them is called vitamin D. Remember we talked about how vitamin D puts calcium where it needs to be?
Yeah,
without
D.
without vitamin D, calcium goes wherever the hell it wants to. Controlling your blood pressure and controlling your blood sugar because of the oxidative process that the sugar has on your blood vessels. And if you have, like, your blood vessel gets stretched, calcium will fill in and deposit on it, and that will cause the stenosis of the valve or hardening of the valve, if you think of stenosis.
Yeah. Well, they said it's all mild, and I'm like, okay, let me know when it's moderate, and then, you know.
No, don't get that point. You know, now that you know it's mild, make sure you've got good levels of vitamin D. Calcium levels are normal. Yeah, and you control your blood pressure, and you control, you know, your blood sugars. Cholesterol plaques also can form on something, and then say your body cleans the plaque off, but it does leave some scar tissue on things at times, and that can also cause stenosis, regurge, other things too. So, those three things:
omega-3,
cholesterol, sugar, and vitamin D.
Would omega-3 help that at all, or is that just for cholesterol in your heart?
Omega-3 is very important. It's not just for cholesterol. It has a lot to do. You need the omega-3s to form the myelin sheath on your neurons, like on your nerves.
Oh, okay.
And the omega-3 assists with your vitamin B12. So if you don't have enough omega-3s in your system, the B12 cannot be used to make the myelin that covers the nerves, and you can end up with a lot of neuropathy and deficiency of B12. One particular omega fatty acid chain, eicosanoic, it starts with the EIC. That one is responsible, and it comes from the fish oils that help you reduce your triglycerides. So That's very important as far as cholesterol goes, too. So omega-3 is good for the triglycerides, and omega-3 is good for creating the myelin on the nerve endings.
See, here's the thing about the omega-3. I used to take them a lot, and then I quit because I'll be damned. When they dissolve in your stomach or your intestines and you start burping that shit up, all you taste is that nasty fish taste from the capsule. It's awful.
Yeah, well, if you're taking the omega-3 from the fish oil itself, yeah, that's horrible. A lot of heartburn, burping the fish oil.
Is it bad
but
to take it when you...
There's other omega-3 that do not have the fish oil component to it, and there's even omega-3s that are vegetarian now.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
So, yeah, but, you know, if you look for, you know, look for the different brands that says not from fish oil or no fish oil side effects on them and or the vegetarian forms of them. But there's also the 369. So there's omega 369. There's a bunch of different omegas, but omega 3 is really important for a lot of different reasons.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you with having like problems with your spinal nerves and pinched nerves and things like that, you definitely want to make sure you got a good balance of omega-3, you got a good balance of your B12, and your folic acid. So that will help reduce a lot of the neuropathy, and your magnesium and your potassium levels as far as your muscles.
I'm taking magnesium for the bones and muscles, and a couple other ones, the B12, or the B-complex, that's what I'm taking. And then I'll add the omega 3, but I'll find the one without the fish oil because dang, nasty. I really do
Do your favor if you get a chance. Go buy one in like the GNC stores, or even look online, or even with a compounding pharmacy. Find a multivitamin with minerals and omegas. That way you can take a capsule instead of taking a bowl of cereal of pills.
Yeah, and you're not taking a mouthful.
Yeah, I mean, doctors will prescribe omega-3 one day and then come in and 12 another day, and then they'll put them on, you know, this, the vitamin C, zinc, magnesium. Next thing you know, these patients are taking...
The only thing with some of the one-a-days, it's like 5% of whatever vitamin that mineral that you're really needing. And I'm like, ooh, 5%.
Then you take two.
Yeah, but that's only 10%. I mean, at what percent do you really need...
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing. You don't get 100% of your supplementation from the supplement. The supplement does not work unless it binds with food. So you still have to eat a healthy diet. And you only take them when you eat. You don't take them on empty stomachs. So even though it's an additional 5% to your normal diet, look at it that way. Not just 5% of your daily.
Okay. There is one brand, I forgot what it's called. One of my patients is taking it, and literally it was almost 100% of your daily for like a majority of your important vitamins and minerals. And honestly, it's a white bottle with a green, I don't know if it's a green leaf or partially a green label. And I'll have to look it up again. They got it at Walmart or something, and for the life of me, I cannot remember what it was. But it's not like Centrum or...
It's like Nature's Way, something like that.
Something like Nature's Way or Nature something or another. And I did find it. And there is a complete, and it does, it literally complete list of everything, not just pick and choose and give you three of that. And
I mentioned that I like to practice functional medicine, and I like to do micronutrient testing and bioidentical hormone testing. And when I find the deficiencies that you have, I can specially compound a supplement for you based upon what you might be missing, what you might need more of, based upon some advanced testing that we do. This is not covered by insurance. Can't even get it covered by insurance, and we're treating you with natural things such as zinc and magnesium and vitamin and methyl MMPHR, and you know, these things that are the underlying causes for a lot of illness that are not addressed. And I think functional medicine is so much more effective, but you're still, a lot of times you end up fighting genetics. But that is also, a lot of those conditions from the genetics, especially for metabolism, is reversible. So you can find a specifically designed compound that has all of the, for example, your doctor wants you to take 500 milligrams of B12, and he wants you to take, you know, 50 milligrams of zinc, and he wants you to take 4,000 milligrams of omega-3, you know. You can find a supplement that contains those ingredients, or you can have it specifically compounded at a compounding pharmacy or with doctors who practice functional medicine. They can do those for you as well. So I've always said that capsules are better than pills, because they put extra things in pills to keep them bind together. There's a lot of psyllium, and there's a lot of plastic type of phthalates in a pill, whereas the capsules, as soon as the gel cap dissolves, it absorbs much, much faster with more of the nutrients that your body needs. So if you have a choice between a capsule and a pill, a solid pill versus a capsule, go for the capsule. It's going to be a much better absorbed, but it's going to be a little more expensive.
What about things like your gel tabs, like things more that are interpreted to gel tabs or things like that? Because you know, Tylenol.
Right. So like Tylenol would be better to take it in the gel tab or in a capsule versus a solid pill form of the Tylenol.
Okay. Yeah, I know when they make, if you look at aspirin, and this is the reason why a lot of people can't take regular aspirin, because it's not coated. And that's why they now have like the enteric coated aspirin, and it doesn't destroy your stomach like the regular baby aspirin per se, or the regular bear aspirin, Ecotrin, which is aspirin. It's a brand. I don't know if they still make it or not, but it does have coating on it. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of my patients have had to switch over to the coated aspirin because of their stomach. So,
sure. And they're still supposed to take it with food.
With food or water, milk, or whatever?
Yeah, well, not water, but...
When they say take with milk, is that mainly because of the vitamin... Is it mainly because of the vitamin D that's in the milk, or the calcium that's in the milk?
No. To take it with food or milk is designed so that you insulate the lining of the stomach from the medication. It's act as an insulation, because milk is a little bit thicker than water per se. It's more viscous.
Okay.
I don't recommend milk, but milk is like an emergency. But I recommend always taking, unless it specifically says on an empty stomach, every single medication with some food. imagine the pill sitting on the bottom of your stomach, and as it's dissolving, it's sandblasting the tissue of your stomach, and over time it can create ulcers. Bleeding
yeah.
ulcers, which can get infected.
What would be the purpose of taking foods without medicine? Is it mainly because of the food absorbing it, or
certain medications you want to take? There's two medications I can think of. One of them is going to be like a Nexium Omeprazole, a proton pump inhibitor, meaning you want that medication to dissolve and coat your stomach so that it reduces the hydrogen acid buildup that occurs during digestion. So that's taken on an empty stomach for that reason. You take it 30 minutes before you eat. Another one is alendronate, which it's a bisphosphonate. You're going to take that one 30 minutes before you eat on an empty stomach so that it absorbs through and binds to the hydrogen so that that bisphosphonate can, you know, help you prevent osteoporosis. It's done once a week. And you have to be sitting upright.
Okay.
You have to be sitting upright so that the gravity keeps the medicine on the bottom of your stomach. That's where it needs to be. If you're laying down, that medicine getting up to the top of your stomach can cause some scarring and other problems and digestion.
Yeah.
Okay, but thyroid medication, I also recommend taking that one on an empty stomach as well. So you're going to take thyroid medication. You're going to take your heartburn, like your Nexium or your Pepcid, Omeprazole, not Pepcid, Prilosec. So Nexium, Prilosec, Omeprazole, those medications are taken on an empty stomach. There's only a few that are specifically taken on an empty stomach. If it says take with food, definitely take it with food. If it doesn't specify,
okay.
Take it with food.
Yeah, a lot of your antibiotics are going to be taken with food because they're just so, like, bathroom. Some of them, like, Catholic. Some of them make me sick to my stomach. You know, one of the main reasons why.
Have you ever taken Flagyl?
Yeah.
You know, that's I think Flagyl is like a crazy, crazy medication. It has so many uses. But if you drink alcohol with Flagyl, you can get an anabuse-like reaction. Do you know that?
Yeah, I was wondering why some medications you can't take with alcohol. Some of them, we'll see, it potentiates this and it makes it even more. Some medications, it lessens the effect. You know, I guess it all depends on the medication.
Hey, do you have that graph that I sent you earlier, dividing the athletes less than 35 and the ones over 35 and the most common causes of sudden death in those athletes?
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. There's another graph. I don't know if this is the same graph.
It's in your should be your text.
Oh, hold on a second. Where's that graph? Was it that? It wasn't a graph, but. No, is it the one that said common cardiovascular conditions associated with sudden death? Hello? You there?
I'm here. Are you there?
I'm here.
There you go. Okay, I'm back. The very last message I sent you was a screenshot.
Yeah, I know. There was one that says, it wasn't a graph, but it says sudden cardiac death in younger athletes less than 35 is commonly due to inherited cardiac condition, while in older athletes over 35, it's most often due to coronary artery disease. But there was no graph that you sent.
Oh, okay. So this one was just common cardiovascular conditions that cause sudden death. It didn't have to do with the ages, but if you had a structurally abnormal heart, you know, there's different reasons. If you acquired an abnormal structure to the heart, there's different reasons. There's different reasons to have a normal heart, and you can see where
is it one? Okay.
The top part
this
is genetic.
It says HCM, which is the heart hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, 36% of athletes younger than 35, and then possible HCM, 8%. Coronary artery abnormalities is about 20%. Myocarditis is, actually, I can read this, 6%.
Right. Well, see, I sent you the screenshot of that, right? But then I sent you the entire article, the sudden cardiac death in athletes. That's the entire article, which is from the National Institute of Health, and it's one of those scholarly articles. So it's, yeah, it's fascinating. You get started top.
You
Sent
me three videos, and then
So click on the one that says sudden cardiac death in athletes, and it's a link to WWNCBI.
Nope. He did not.
yeah, I did, but
no?
I'll resend.
Okay, you sent me this brown one, and it's got congenital genetic structural abnormality, abnormal heart, acquired, structurally or normal heart, but there's no link.
No.
Okay.
It was the one right before that one. The one right before that one at 5:51 I sent it, but I just sent it. I resent it again.
Now I got the article.
Okay, now click on the article there, and scroll to the very top, and then.
Yep.
Let's see. It defines what they mean by an athlete. And then the causes of sudden cardiac death in athletes. Most common cause is shown in that table. So that's one of the tables that I sent you. That's in athletes under 35. Yeah, over 35. And then the older athletes, there's common causes of that too. But the
tables don't open up all the way on my phone. That could be what the problem is.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, that's the problem. I mean, what I might do is saving all of these articles that I start getting, and I'm going to print them out just so I can have them, and I'm going to have a whole notebook of them, and that's what I'm going to do. Ooh, shit. No, don't do that.
The risk of causes.
Myself.
The risk and causes of sudden cardiac death vary based upon the athletic population. Male gender, black race, and basketball participation all place an athlete at higher risk. Sudden cardiac death in younger athletes, and when anybody younger is less than 35, is commonly due to inherited cardiac conditions, while in the older athlete greater than 35, it's usually due to atherosclerotic coronary artery disease, meaning hardening of the arteries, or you know, the artery itself, the lumen inside, the hole inside is much smaller, reduced. And here's where our dilemma is as doctors, that there remains significant debate over the best strategy to prevent sudden cardiac death in athletes and the role of an EKG in pre-participation screening. So optimum pre-participation evaluation for a group of athletes depend on the risk and the population. So if you are a black male playing basketball under 35 years old, you definitely should get a good EKG screening. And that's basically what this whole article is saying.
Yeah.
Yep. But, yeah, I was fascinated by that that – Bugadera syndrome or whatever. That's another inherited one.
Oh, yeah, I even looked that one up, too. Hold on one. I'm trying to multitask here. Hold on one second. Okay. So that, oh, crap. Blah, 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 blah. Let's see. Hold on a second. Add this page. Going to save that. And the Brugada?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That was on one of the videos I think I sent.
Oh, okay. Well, I actually, what I did, yeah, you sent me a video, but then I went on and got it on Mayo Clinic. It's a rare but potentially life-threatening heart rhythm condition that's inherited, sometimes inherited. People with Brugada have increased risk of irregular heart rhythms beginning in the lower chambers of the heart, which is the ventricles. Treatment includes preventative measures such as reducing fever, avoiding medications that may trigger an arrhythmia. Some people with Brugada syndrome need medical device called an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, or an ICD.
And that is where it will give you a shock to get your heart back into normal rhythm.
Huh. This is kind of weird, but I think I'm hoping this is attributed to my swollen adenoids. So some of the signs and symptoms: dizziness, fainting, gasping, and labored breathing, particularly at night. You know, like
that's
when you're
what
sleeping.
Happens. That's what happens when I have sex these days.
I wish I wouldn't know. When I'm sleeping, if I sleep on my back, I'll do this gasping sound because I stop breathing and I wake up. And so that's why they did the sleep apnea, but I don't have sleep apnea. Is that what they're talking about? The gasping? Or is that like
that,
difficulty breathing?
That sounds like a sleep apnea. If you pause your breathing and then you but, you know, gasp to get air, that kind of sounds like sleep apnea.
I had the sleep apnea test, and it's not. They say it's my adenoids. And
well, that's an obstruction. That's an obstruction, kiddo.
I know.
That is a sleep apnea.
Huh?
That is a sleep apnea. It's an obstructive
well,
sleep
apnea. You
know apnea.
What? It's the VA. It's the VA. That's
mm-hmm.
all I got to say.
Okay. They're probably trying to throw some BS at you then if they're calling it your adenoids and saying you don't have OSA. That's OSA is obstructive sleep apnea, meaning something's causing an obstruction. Stop your breathing.
I know. But here's the thing. It only happens if I lay flat on my back. If I sleep on my side or on my stomach, it doesn't happen. It's only when I lay on my back.
And when you're laying on your back, gravity's pulling everything down. So if you do have large adenoids, it's going to pull it down to block off your windpipe.
Yeah. Well, that's
like
what
having
saying.
Large tonsils.
That's what
yeah.
you're saying the problem is. But I was just
maybe
gasping.
Maybe this is your problem. I just sent you another screenshot when you get it.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. This isn't your problem. But it's fascinating.
Well, no,
this is
it
fascinating
always,
for men and women.
You know, it sounds like you're snoring. You know, if you snort when you laugh, that little snort. So
uh-huh.
That's what I do for the breathing. And
yeah, that's your adenoids.
Oh, no, it's just all at once. It's like. It's one of those. It's really weird when I do it, and it wakes me up. But like I said, it's only if I lay on my back or if my pillow is too high, and it kind of pushes compression on my, you know, when it pushes your head up too far.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it does it. But no, I didn't know if that was the same when they say gasping or labored breathing. If that would be considered the same thing, like when you gasp, we call it guppy breathing. Like if you're, you know, like that.
Yeah,
gasping.
That's different. That's different. Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
When they say gasping for air is like when you stop breathing for a second, and then your body tells you, hey, you got to breathe. And then you breathe. And the reason you stop breathing for a second is because your airway was blocked off for a second. For example, if you're breathing through your nose and your nose is stuffed up, you're going to eventually breathe through your mouth. Like a person snoring real bad, if you pinch their nose, the snoring's going to stop, but they're going to wake up gasping for air. Because the snoring is coming from the adenoids a lot of times at the back of the nose.
Yeah, and see, my son does that, and he snores like a freaking chainsaw, and it happens to him if he lays on his back. That's why he sleeps slightly elevated.
Tell him to try using Breathe Right strips.
He's done it.
Like the football players use those big old black pieces of tape across their cheeks.
That
kind of helps sometimes. For people who have, you know, obstructive sleep apnea, a special mouthpiece that pushes the lower jaw forward slightly will help keep the airway open too, but those can become expensive. So you don't have to be on a CPAP machine.
Yeah, his dad has sleep apnea and it's never been diagnosed, so he doesn't know if he does. Honestly, if I have that, but like I said, it only happens to me very rarely. It's only when I sleep flat on my back that I'll gasp and I'll stop breathing when I sleep. If I'm on my side, it never happens.
That's definitely gravity, right? It's got to be gravity, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe a solution is put two bricks underneath the head of your bed to elevate your bed.
Yeah,
that's what they recommend for people who have bad acid reflux. Like when they lay down, they'll get acid reflux, and that causes them problems where they stop breathing too, as the acid comes up into the esophagus while they're sleeping. It causes really bad heartburn and all kinds of other problems. So if you raise the bed and let gravity help keep the acid down into the stomach by putting a couple boards underneath blocks or bricks under the head of the bed to raise the bed up. Sometimes just something simple like that alone can resolve discomfort in your
life. Yeah, the other thing is some people use two pillows. But if I use two pillows, I have to make them offset so it's not pushing my head all the way full up. Like it's pinching off my windpipe. So I kind of like put one under my back and one under my head, and it kind of elevates that way. And I have noticed a big difference in the way I sleep. But anyway.
But try putting the bricks under the head of the bed to raise the bed up slightly and see if that makes a difference.
Well, for the next 4 weeks, I got to sleep on the couch or my chair with my shoulder. You can't lay flat. So more of the symptoms. Extremely fast, chaotic heartbeat or seizures. And so with Brugada, they say, some of the signs and symptoms are similar to those of some other heart rhythm disorders. But here's the thing, with any, it doesn't have to be this. If you have anything, you're just going normal every day, trucking along, and all of a sudden you got something abnormal out of your life, whether it's with work, exercise, or any activity, sleeping, whatever, write it down. What it is, when it started, how long it lasts, does it hurt, what makes it better, what makes it worse, and go see your doctor. And they will go from there to say, hey, you know what, you need to see a specialist, and we'll send you to this doctor or whatever. That way they can rule out a plethora of 400,000 diseases that there may be.
Don't ever let your doctor chalk up symptom of palpitation to anxiety.
Oh, true.
Because if they know you got anxiety and you have palpitations, the first thing you're going to think, but every palpitation needs a cardiac workup. It's not necessarily anxiety. Even acid reflux can cause the symptoms of palpitations. And they say normally if you're having a flutter or an arrhythmia, you're not going to feel the palpitation of the heart. But I disagree with that, especially under a high blood pressure circumstance.
I used to have PVCs all the time. And I don't have them anymore. And if I do, it's like few and far between now. But I used to have them bad. And that's the cardiac workup, you know, and they put you on medications, this, that, and the other. And the one thing that irritates me to no end is, like you were saying about heart palpitations, if you were under 40 years old, they automatically dismiss any heart pain, any heart problems as a panic attack or anxiety or a GERD or acid reflux, heartburn, all that. They automatically dismiss you and send you on your way. And they're having a big, I've seen plenty of videos on this that a lot of doctors are now starting to look more into people under 40 having heart problems and why.
Well, the other thing is that they're teaching in medical school too now, they're focusing on, is atypical myocardial infarction in females. A female comes in with abdominal pain, it could be a heart attack. And could be under 40. But look, you can look that up. Look at it for atypical myocardial infarctions in females. I don't know why, it's just females, but, you know, they'll come in with just abdominal pain, and it winds up being an MI. And it's usually under 40.
Typical what?
Atypical myocardial infarction in females.
Yeah, I was 34 when I had my first heart attack. And they just dismissed it, and, you know, that was that. And they're like, but because my dad was 38 when he had his first one, and I was 34.
Yeah.
I had when I was 40 and then 42.
Knowing just the family history alone would tell you to do the workup.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, find out about that atypical presentation, atypical myocardial infarction in females. When I did my emergency room rotations, female come in with abdominal pain, you had to rule out a myocardial infarction.
But that's what I'm saying. They're just dismissing, you know, oh, you're having a panic attack. I know. And see, you know, they ask me still, and when I say I'm having chest pains, I'm like, look, I already know the difference between a panic attack and my typical when I've had my angina attack, which I haven't had issues because I'm on the isothorbide, mononitrate, and I haven't had issues with it for the last couple of years. But they'll ask you, is this your norm? Because when I had one of my heart attacks, I mean, yes, they were mild ones. Don't get me wrong. One of them they called an episode because they don't like calling it a heart attack. But I had jaw pain, lower jaw pain, and pain down my left arm, the cold sweat, and all of that. I had everything typical for a woman. But, like, I don't know if men have lower jaw pain or not when they have.
They can have jaw pain, shoulder pain, arm pain, chest pain. They could, you know, the presentation varies. There's been heart attacks that don't even have an ST elevation. They call it non-STEMI. They call them silent heart attacks. And anytime the blood flow is interrupted to the heart muscle, it's called an infarction. So an ischemic event occurred, which stopped the blood flow to the heart for some reason for a minute, and that muscle doesn't get blood flow, and that is what a myocardial or heart attack is. A lot of times it's due to clogged vessels or other reasons that cause ischemia. But yeah, so you can have an EKG when you're 50 and and you're going to see that EKG said myocardial infarction of unknown age indeterminate, that you may have had a heart attack a long time ago and not even known it because the symptoms were so, you know.
Yeah.
Who knows?
But
just shoulder pain.
Just
shoulder pain, yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. They got to stop. Oh, well, you're young. You're having a panic attack. No. No.
Yep.
And sometimes they'll listen. If you have a good doctor or a good nurse doing, you know, whatever, they'll listen to you and they'll pay attention, especially your family history. Like, I have one spot, I have an ischemic spot on my left ventricle. My father had it. Both of his parents had it. And his older sister had it. The two younger brothers, I don't think they did. But each and every one of us all have an ischemic spot on the left ventricle, same spot on our heart. So I don't know if it's genetic. It's just a freak thing.
A genetic malformation. You can have arterial and ventricle malformation. Arterial and veins. Your arteries and veins can have a little malformation in them, which can cause ischemia and lead to, you know, necrotic muscle tissue in the heart. But as long as that particular muscle fiber doesn't interfere with the inflow and outflow of the blood, you'll be fine unless it begins to spread.
No, and that it'll never heal, though. That's once your heart tissue is necrotic, it'll never, you know. But then other veins grow around it, you know, and, well, so they say.
Yeah, and that's exactly why they do bypass artery grafts, you know, CABG, they call them, right?
Yeah.
So when you have a clogged artery, they'll take a blood vessel out of your leg and they'll put it up in your heart to bypass the clogged artery so that your heart muscle can get circulation. If it doesn't get blood flow, it dies, and then it can't contract.
Yeah. So let's finish off this Brugada. some of the causes.
Sounds like a car. Sounds like a race
car.
I
know, Brugada. So
a Bugatti.
Each beat of the heart is, huh?
A Bugatti.
I was just going to say, isn't it a Bugatti?
Yeah.
So each beat of the heart is triggered by an electrical signal by special cells in the right upper chamber of the heart. So tiny pores called channels on each of these cells directs this electrical activity, which makes the heart beat. So in Brugada, a change in these channels caused the heartbeat to beat too fast, and that's the V-fib. And as a result, the heart doesn't pump enough blood to the rest of the body.
Yep. And VTAC, V-fib causes death.
Yeah.
You can live
Definitely.
With AFib, but you're not going to live very long with V-fib.
Oh, I was just going to ask you that because I've had patients quite a bit of older ones with AFib, but none with V-fib. V-fib, you pretty well, you know, go asystole. Now,
V-fib, you have to shock them. You have to cardiovert them to get that back in rhythm because it's out of rhythm with the atrium. The ventricles are beating faster than the atrium, and the ventricles is what pushes the blood out to the body. And so if you don't get that in sync, you're going to die. So that's why they shock them or they cardiovert them. You can have V-fib. Mild cases of V-fib, or no, it's more like VTAC. You can have a ventricle tachycardia, and they can shock and cardiovert it back into a good rhythm. But when you get into ventricular fibrillation, that is like you're talking 5 minutes from death.
Yeah. There's this T-shirt. It's one of the nursing T-shirts, and I wanted to get it, and it says, "Calm down." And it says, not that calm. And it's, the person's in VTAC. And then it goes, when they say calm, at the top of the thing, it says, calm down. And then it goes asystole and goes, not that calm.
Not that calm.
Here's a common,
But it's one of those cool t-shirts where I'm like, I'm not a cardiac nurse anymore, so I'm like, I don't want to get that shirt. But is it true, and this is what I learned back 20-some-odd years ago, and I know how a lot of things change over time on how things. Is it true that if you go into asystole, flatline, dead, done, can that heart rate be brought back by getting shots, or can you actually come back from that?
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Okay.
That happened to my dad.
Huh?
That happened to my dad. He went to the doctor because his throat was severely sore, and as soon as he walked into the hospital door, he was dead. And they were on top of it, and they brought him back, put a defibrillator and pacemaker in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were always told this. Like I said, this was back in the day, and they said if you go asystole, you cannot bring that back by shocking. So I didn't know, if that was true.
I don't know how they brought him back, but all I know is he died and they got him back. I don't know all the details.
Yeah, there's some rhythms that won't work with shocking, but other rhythms will work with just medications, and that's why we take ACLS. Certain medications can induce the muscle fibers to start producing contractions, but asystole flatline, you will definitely want to shock them to see if you can induce those muscle fibers to start contracting, but you're also going to need medications on top of that. And so it has come a long way since what you were talking about, but there's been a lot of advances in advanced cardiac life support.
Oh yeah.
I mean, a lot of times if you're flatline, they're going to do CPR instead of shocking. Most of the times they're going to do the shocking when your rhythm is out of whack. So like when the bottom part of the heart is beating faster than the top part of the heart, they call that an arrhythmia, then they're going to want to shock it. Flatline, a lot of times they're not even going to shock it. They're just going to do CPR to try to make that heart muscle start pushing blood through the body. So your answer is yes. Once you're flatline, the only thing that's going to make that heart start beating again is if the electrical system starts firing and you use mechanical compression to beat the heart to keep circulation going through the body, or chemicals. But if I was lying there flatline on the fucking table, you better shock me.
Well, no, I know. I just didn't know, if that was one of those. But like I said, everything's changed. Everything changes.
It changes every 2 years. That's why you have to go and update your CPR every 2 years, even basic life support. It's going to be 30 breaths now. Oh, it's going to be 15 breaths, or it's going to be 15 compressions in two. Every year it changes, and it's based upon evidence-based medicine. So,
oh yeah.
Well, I have some good news for you folks.
Sure.
So here I am, fully vaccinated, but I got the two required mandatory vaccines to continue my career. And last week, I had a whole week of having COVID. It was awesome. The worst freaking headache of my life. The worst headache
weather's
of my life. Fever, chills.
COVID.
Yeah, probably Omicron, probably one of those variants. But we all got it. Me, Bobby, and my son, we all ended up with my son. I want to kick him in the butt because he had no symptoms whatsoever other than a positive test. And my wife, she still has a nagging dry cough, and I just have fatigue. I, And she's got some brain fog, too. So, but I'm like, man.
You might have
the
second time. The second
Who?
Time I got COVID, I had that brain fog. Like,
uh-huh.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
didn't
but Bobby uh-huh. always had brain fog.
Well, yeah. Well, she said she got the brain fog after she met Bobby in South Carolina because her head was all messed up after thinking about him.
That I believe.
No
and,
doubt.
But no, she got the brain fog after getting the vaccine, the second vaccine. And then with the variant that she picked up from me last week, I guess it made it a little bit worse, but now she's on the – now at least she remembers who Bobby is and what he looks like now.
Yeah, I didn't do the – nope. The only thing I'm required that I have to do is I have to get a flu shot. I don't have to get the COVID vaccine, which I'm not going to. And, you know, my job requires flu shots every year, which I don't have a problem
yeah.
with that.
Yeah, my hospital privileges – For the hospital privileges, I have to have at least the two COVIDs. I don't have to have the booster. It's optional. I have to have the flu shot every year. I have to do a TB screening every year as well. And I'm thinking about...
Oh, I was going to ask about that.
What about?
You know, in most medical professional jobs, you have to have a TB test every year, right? So
yeah.
It's the TB skin test, right? Well, now... They've swapped over to the blood test. And
okay, well,
weird,
that's an interferon gamma release assay, and that really doesn't check for active TB. It checks for latent TB.
Well, here's the weird thing. One of the nurses, she did the TB test, of course, when she got hired, and it was fine. It was negative. So she had to redo it again. And they did the blood test, and it showed positive.
Uh-huh.
And then she had to go and
latent.
Have a chest X-ray, and it said
which showed
negative.
She's been exposed to late. It's called latent TB.
Oh, okay. So that it's not a false positive. It's a.
She's probably had tuberculosis. Have been exposed to it in the past. And she's a TB carrier, but it's just not active.
Well, she has...
Now, pregnancy can cause a false positive on that test.
She has ulcerative colitis, and she's got a lot of issues with her immune system sucking really bad. So
yeah, that sounds like
I didn't
a shitty
know
issue.
If that could be part of the problem or...
Autoimmune conditions and lupus sometimes can cause a false positive on that test. But the protocol is if it's positive, then we treat it as if it's a late TB infection. Doesn't necessarily have to be active. And the funny thing is with tuberculosis, is that tuberculosis most commonly gets in the respiratory tract and is spread through the water droplets. But tuberculosis can also hide in your liver, your spleen, your intestinal tract, and it's not infectious unless it's in the pulmonary system. Yeah, unless it's spreading through the air. But you can have you can have caseating granulomas in your liver and your kidneys that are actually TB, but it's not causing. They don't care about it unless it's in the lungs, basically, is what I'm saying. So you can that test could be positive, but we indicate it as being a latent TB infection or as if you're a carrier of TB. You have it, you're not actively infected with pulmonary TB.
Oh. Now, okay, here's this. Why would a chest X-ray be good for 2 years, but you have to have the TB skin test or blood test done every year? Wouldn't
no.
it be the same?
Even if you had a clear chest X-ray, you would still next year have to have another TB test. And if
no. No, huh? They're saying that a chest x-ray is good for 2 years. So I won't have to do the TB test again next year.
That might be just your company. Might just be your company.
Okay.
That's not, yeah, no. Most hospitals, nursing homes, anywhere, you know, a physician has privileges in a group environment, they require an annual screening. Here where I live in South Texas, there's a lot of Mexican-American people here, a lot of Mexican nationals who live and work here too, and they get a vaccine in their country called a BCG vaccine. And what happens when they get that BCG vaccine, when they do a tuberculin skin test, or they call the PPD, it shows positive. So we send them for chest x-rays, and based upon the history of the BCG vaccine, every year they are now required to have the chest x-ray instead of the TB skin test, because some people are positive converters, and it can convert positive for autoimmune conditions. That BCG vaccine is a reason. So they're going to be positive on the skin test every time. So they have to get the chest x-ray every year. If you want to know if they have latent TB, that's when they do the blood test.
Oh, okay.
But I think a lot more companies are now going for the blood test, because all of the kids that, you know, I told you I take care of the refugee immigrant children who are coming here from other countries. They're unaccompanied minors. We put them in these shelters until they find foster homes or they reunify them with relatives in the U.S. We do the blood test on all of them too, because even though the PPD, we do a PPD on them, we do a chest x-ray, and we do the blood test. We do all three tests on them just to make sure that not carrying infectious diseases into the U.S. I have a situation that happened to me today. I'd like to share with you guys and get your opinion, if you don't mind. You got a few minutes?
Sure.
All right.
Good.
I have a 78-year-old man who ended up getting a urinary obstruction from an enlarged prostate and started having hydronephrosis, and he became septic, went into the hospital, and he ended up having some transient ischemic attacks, little strokes, mini strokes, nothing permanent. But while in the hospital, he was in there for a while, probably about 2 months, and he had atrophic muscles. His muscles went weak. He can no longer walk. So I discharged him from the hospital and ordered him to a rehab nursing home. It's a nursing home and rehab for physical therapy to get his muscle strength back up. He's got Medicare, but he has limited insurance, and his benefits for the rehab ran out. The man can still not walk. The man lives on a second-story apartment. It's been his home for the last 50 years. He wants to – his mind is all there. I mean, his benefits run out. He can't afford to pay the $200 a day rehab. They don't want to discharge him because there's no one that's going to carry him up the second flight of steps to his home. And because he has no family or relatives, he lives by himself, he's not going to be able to take care of himself. But this man wants to go home. He also wants to get his strength back and become independent like he always has been. So he decided he wants to check out of the nursing home against medical advice. So they call me up from the nursing home, the director of nursing, the caseworkers. The family has disowned him. He signed the AMA form on Saturday, and he tried to get an Uber driver to come get him and take him to his home, And the Uber driver refused because he says, I'm not going to just drop you outside and leave you sit on the ground because you can't walk. Called a taxi cab driver. Taxi cab driver refused for the same reason. So he couldn't even get a ride home. So he's still at the nursing home. He's still at the nursing home. And he said he's willing to stay, but he just can't afford it. But he doesn't want to give up his home. The nursing home said, you can become a long-term resident here, but you have to give up your Social Security and all of that to us for your living expenses. And so he says, no. Well, now I'm in the dilemma where I can't allow him to discharge AMA. I can't discharge him AMA, and the only way I can do it is if I get APS involved, as far as I know. Now, do you guys know any tricks of the trade that might help me with this guy? Because he wants to get stronger, but he's not going to be able to live on a second-story apartment because he can't walk.
Assisted
living?
Yeah.
Assisted living as basically kind of the same things as insurance doesn't – have the benefits right now, because he has a Medicare, but it has already run out of the benefits that he has. So the only other thing I can think of is putting him back in the hospital for some other issue. Right now he can walk up two steps and he gets short of breath and doesn't have the strength or the energy to continue. And so he's, you know, bound to, so I'm thinking, okay, shortness of breath, dyspnea on exertion, a cardiac issue most likely, loss of weight, you know, he's cachectic. Let me put him back in the hospital and then redischarge him back to a rehab center. Well, one of the hospitals, the nursing homes where I'm living, they've been playing this game with these hospitals for years, and the hospitals just caught on to it, and now they're looking out for that. So what they're doing, the patient has to be admitted for at least 72 hours before they can discharge him back to a rehab center for some reason, and in order for the insurance companies to pick it up again. And the hospitals are saying, we're not playing that game. If the guy's fine, we're going to discharge him the same day. And
what if he has congestive heart failure?
Well, he probably does. Like I said, he's got dyspnea on exertion. The other thing is, well, the guy's, you know, he's got a Foley catheter in because he had obstruction, and he's on a renal diet because he had hydronephrosis. And he says, well, I don't like the food. I don't have any appetite, and since I can't eat, I can't get stronger. He says, if you allow me a variety of food in my diet, I'll eat more, and then I'll be able to get stronger. And I'm like, fine, we can do that. You'll just have to sign a form that says it's against medical advice for the diet because you're on a renal protocol, but I can make that happen if that's what's going to get
you
better. But he can't pay the $200 a month for the insurance, for the nursing home. And,
Hold on a second.
The nursing, how are we going to discharge this guy home? Nobody's going to live with him. He has no family. Everyone's abandoned him. And if I discharge him, that it's an unsafe discharge.
You know, they make renal protein drinks that would help his nutrition?
They sure do. And they also – I even told him I could give him para-internal nutrition, like through an IV. Just to help him build up his strength. And he said he was even willing to do that. But the fact that his benefits have run out, he doesn't want or can't afford to pay for it to continue therapy. And the fact that they brought this up to me at the time of discharge, they should have brought it up to me 4 weeks ago when he first got there.
You know, and I hate to say this, and this is what's getting, the hospitals are getting a kick in the ass on this. The minute you're admitted to a hospital, they have to start planning for discharge the minute you're put in the hospital.
The minute you're put in the hospital, what they're planning on is how many days they can use your insurance. And they plan on your discharge based upon how many days they can get out of your insurance. So that's the criminal thing.
From the state I've lived in, you have to, the minute they admit you, the social worker has to start going, okay, we have to work on this, 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 and this, and this, and they start. Because here's what their hospitals are doing, and they're getting caught by Medicaid and Medicare. It's called dumping. They wait until Friday, and they're like, we have to empty the hospital because it always gets busy on the weekend. And they send all these old people to nursing homes and with congestive heart failure, this, and, you know, whatever. And they're dumping them into nursing homes and rehabs. And with half the orders missing, and they end up readmitting these patients again over the weekend.
Well, here's what the nursing home's doing. The nursing home is sending the patient to the hospital on a Friday. That way, nothing can really get done over the weekend, and they'll get that 72 hours in there and be discharged Monday. And so they get that 72 hours in, and they can send them back to the rehab. Well, the hospital's caught on to that nursing home doing the dumping too. And so I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to even go that route with this guy, but what I'm feeling is going to happen is it's going to be a hard lesson learned, but medicine is a privilege. It's not a right. And this, you know, my patient is going to end up probably dead falling down those stairs. And there's not a damn thing I can do about it other than pay for it out of my own pocket, which I can't afford that either, you know?
He needs a social worker with Medicare. He should have one.
This is coming from his social work at the nursing home. And what they want is they want him in long-term or assisted living. But in order for that, he's got to give up his Social Security benefits to them, and he doesn't want to give them up. And he says, just let me go home and die.
He gets to keep some of them.
I don't know. Texas is kind of weird. And also, he's not going to qualify if, for example, in the last 5 years, he's owned anything of significant value.
So
they check back. Yeah, they check back 5 years on that shit.
Two-minute warning.
But, yeah, anyway, this is one of the sad things I'm dealing with today, and my doctor, she's no fucking help either. She's just like, just tell them to discharge AMA and call APS. That's it. Don't even try
to
find something.
That's pretty much all you
can do. Yeah. True.
Well, guys,
love you guys.
Another great show. God bless y'all. Thank you, Kimmy, Phil, Lorna. God bless America. God bless our children, our veterans, first responders, military, and God bless the Defender 7. Good night, everybody.
God bless you guys. Good night.
Good night.